Okay, good day and welcome to a flat pack history of Sweden.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Elsa. Thank you for joining us for our first episode of historical content in this podcast. This isn't really exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I'm really looking forward to getting started on the history. And we should get straight into it here at Flat Pack History of Sweden, our first ever episode. So, yeah, as we said, as we promised, we're going to start every episode with a Swedish phrase. Mm-hmm. So I think for this week, we'll start with one of my favourites, which is tur i otur.
Well, tur i otur and literally means luck in bad luck. So that would be something like, say you dropped a piece of toast, but it landed with the buttered side up, so it was fine.
Yeah, okay. Or maybe slightly more dramatic, if you got hit by a car, but it was by an ambulance inside the hospital grounds. Like, that's kind of good luck in bad luck.
Yeah, it's fortunate circumstances in an unfortunate situation.
Yeah. And actually, I have an amazing story to share that's nothing to do with me, but for some reason has always stuck in my mind. It was this... I think it was a woman who was flying from the UK to America on a plane, obviously, as you do. She had a heart attack on the plane and they did the whole bling blong, is there any doctors on the plane? And there were actually something like 15 heart specialists who were all going to a cardiology conference in Atlanta or Florida or somewhere. And yeah, so she was like had perfect healthcare given to her on the plane, which was... luck in bad luck.
That would be the definition of a circumstance where it's tur i oturen.
Yeah.
All right. So that was our first Swedish phrase. Now let's dive into some history.
Most definitely. So, yeah, it's now time to open the instruction leaflet for our Flat Pack History of Sweden and see what the very first page has to offer. Unfortunately, there's no cool little blob figures showing you how to use the pieces like you get in flat pack furniture guide, but
I'm sure, and we can just imagine blob figures.
Okay, yeah, sure. Right, let's imagine this blob figure who's taking us on this tour of Swedish history. But so as we mentioned in the introductory episode, first few parts of the history is definitely going to focus on a period of history that has many names, which all really mean the same thing. There's prehistory, before there was Sweden, pre-Sweden.
Exactly. We are going to cover a huge period of history, and the numbers are quite staggering, really. The first people lived in the area of modern Sweden, perhaps as early as 400,000 years ago. But that was before a succession of glacial periods.
Yeah, and I don't even think I can begin to imagine what the world was like 400,000 years ago. Absolutely nothing would be the same as it is today. I mean, in that time, mammoths were around, wandering about the place, eating, chilling out.
Yeah, there have actually been a few mammoth finds in Sweden. One was found in central Stockholm in the middle of the 1800s, and there was actually one as recent as 2011 in the city of Umeå.
Oh, and that's quite north Sweden, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess they were dead mammoths.
Yeah, they were most definitely dead mammoths. But, yeah, Sweden was essentially unrecognizable.
Okay, yeah, and as this is more of a... the history, more to do with people rather than geology and geography. So I guess we should probably skip forward to when the time that humans begin writing their part in the history of Sweden. So doing a bit of research for this, I really do like this quote from The History of Sweden, a good introductory book, I guess, from Brian Nordstrom. So he says, "People have lived in what is now called Sweden for a very long time. Although forced to leave by successive glaciations, inhabitants have lived there perhaps as long as 400,000 years. We know the most about only the last 13,000 years or so, since the melting of the most recent glaciers. The record of all prehistory lies in archaeological materials." That's now not the quote, end quote. And that's the key point, really, isn't it? Prehistory really means before recorded history in a literary sense. And so we'll go quite a few episodes before we even reach the first literary references to Sweden or people thought to be residing in Sweden. I guess 10 points to the listeners if you can guess who the first person to write about the Swedish people were. Also, do you have a clue?
So who were the first person to write about the Swedish people?
Yep.
Is it a famous person?
Very famous. Kind of.
Is it Stephen Fry?
No. I mean, the first person we have records of writing about.
All right.
So the earliest person to write about Swedish.
Is it Caesar?
It's not Caesar.
Is it some Roman guy?
It is a Roman guy. It's Tacitus.
Oh.
So I think it was about 100 AD. But yeah, so
wow.
There was a Roman guy, Tacitus, a Roman historian. For more info on Romans, History of Rome, Mike Duncan, etc., other amazing podcasts, we'll leave that to them.
Because this is really far into history now. When Sweden was first mentioned,
yeah.
We need to rewind and come back to what we were talking about, which was the first Swedes and the first settlement in Sweden. There is a lot of history to cover. So shall we start somewhere around that 13,000 years ago? So in 11,000 BC.
Perfect. So, of course, with everything this far back, interpretation is both key and difficult. So is a fancy tool just fancy because it was an icon or an offering to religious things, an example of social elites or stratification in society? Or was it just because the person making that particular tool on that particular day felt like making it a little bit more fancy than his other ones just because it was more fun, maybe? You can get 10 archaeologists in a room and you'll probably get at least 5 different interpretations. But there is a consistent view on a lot of these things, which is obviously updated over time, but we're going to be trying to give you the decided upon, most accepted.
At the same time, there's nothing wrong with a bit of debate. Debate drives research, drives our understanding of things. And
yeah.
There will be plenty of debates on historical matters throughout this, and that's not a bad thing. On the contrary, that's a good thing. So the history, it does follow a relatively, should we call it, standard pattern of chronology. There's no jumping from mammoths to the Iron Age, as fun as that would be. So we are going to travel through the, and now for some difficult words for me to say, Paleolithic and Mesolithic ages to the Neolithic age. Some people might call these the Old, Middle, and New Stone Age. I might be one of those people because that was easier to say.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, let's start in the Paleolithic time. Around 13,000 years ago in 11,000 BCE, the ice began to retreat as the climate slowly, and we really do mean slowly, warmed. We're talking about a 3-degree rise in 3,000 years, so slightly slower than what we're seeing in the news and all the climate debate at the moment. But so it raised from about 11 degrees Celsius to an average of 14 in the summer of roughly 8,000 BCE. So as the ice retreated, it didn't really go very far at first. In fact, it only really started beginning to reveal the very bottom of Sweden. So it went from the whole country being covered in ice to just the what's today called Skåne. It's like a county in the very bottom part of Sweden. So if you see Sweden on a map, it's got a sort of like a bumpy bit at the very bottom. So that would be Skåne. Because this ice was retreating, you would actually be able to walk from Sweden to Ireland without getting your feet wet. Central Sweden, Stockholm to Gothenburg, however, was submerged still in ice and a mix of ice and lake.
Well, I'm very happy that Skåne has been revealed from under the ice now because was revealed first because that's where I'm from. So me and my part of Sweden, we've now been revealed from under the ice. But my fellow people down in Skåne didn't exactly have it great at this time. It was still cold and they had to hunt or gather all their food, we won't even be reaching the age of farming in this episode. That's how far back we're talking. Paleolithic Swedes were almost exclusively hunters, mainly of reindeer. Sadly, by this time, there was no mammoths around for them to go hunting.
Yeah, that's a bit of a shame. It must have been pretty boring just hunting reindeer all the time. Everybody needs a bit of variety, and having to chase down a mammoth or something would have been quite fun. But I guess their variety came in the different sizes of reindeer they managed to catch.
And I mean, I must say, reindeer is tasty. I wouldn't want to eat it every day, but nothing wrong in the flavour of reindeer. I think the more interesting parts of life don't really begin until the Mesolithic people start appearing in the south and by this stage also further north in Sweden. The first evidence of human inhabitation of Sweden has been found at several sites in the far south, in places like Stegebro, Ågeröd and Simrishamn. We don't get any evidence from the north because of all that pesky ice until we get to about 7,000 BCE, once we reach the Mesolithic period.
Yeah, so welcome to the Mesolithic period. Between roughly 8,000 BCE and 5,000 BCE, we're rising from that 14 degrees of warmth in the start to a practically tropical average of around 20 degrees Celsius in July by 6,200 BCE.
Well, that's warm. I mean, present-day Swedes wouldn't feel out of place in Skåne 10,000 years ago then.
No. As a result of all this warming and change in surroundings, the people are finally starting to see a bit of variety in their diet.
Mm.
We're actually looking at people who are typically going to be eating all sorts of things, really, being quite healthy as they do it.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, as someone who loves food, I'd be quite happy with their diet, eating meat, fish, clams, grains, nuts, berries. We know that they ate this, really, because of all the archaeology finds, rubbish tips, and whatever is left from these people's roaming settlements.
Because the nature of the changing climate, the roaming animals, which were the main source of the food at this time, and possibly other groups of fellow Swedes competing for the best food spots and settlements were never really permanent at this time. You know, they would be seasonal. And so that doesn't mean that people weren't well adapted for their time, though, with all the tools and gear that they're creating obviously vary massively across the period. But the early Swedes had access to axes, spears, arrows, animal traps, different types of clothing depending on the weather, and primitive structures that were able to be built quite quickly and temporarily to keep out the elements.
Hmm. Of course, all of this technology and culture was really very interchangeable with other countries, even though they weren't countries at the time, and regions. As we mentioned previously, you could walk to Ireland from present-day Sweden if you wanted a quick pint of Guinness. Obviously, then you'd had to wait all the thousands of years until they invented Guinness. So anyway, immigration, trade, and elaborately decorative rock painting ideas, and everything was changeable and influenced by everything. So there wasn't really anything that made the early Swedes stand out much from the early Danes or the early Germans.
Yeah, so the people in the north and the south, now the ice has retreated far up north, they're hunting and systematically gathering from all of the environment's increasingly diversifying resources. Mm-hmm. You've got an increase in the variety of animals. Now you've got elk and wild boar, bears and rabbits, all supplementing the still ever-present reindeer to create quite a mixture in meat available. There's the scavenging and gathering of berries, nuts, roots and seeds, all helping to decrease the reliance on the vital stocks of fish and mussels that they're also fishing.
All this talk of food, it's really quite a feast, and there's a relative abundance of it as well. The struggle for survival in the Paleolithic period, and previous period, has transformed into a time where there was a period of plenty, with even time for leisure, it seems. This is perhaps reflected in the types of carved amulets made of amber and amazing picture stones depicting the cute animals that they were then killing for food.
Yeah, and some of them are quite dramatic. And there is a massive rabbit hole you can delve into in rock paintings and all of that that we don't really have time for today. But there's a wealth of information out there on the internet and in more old school book form that you can read about all these amazing rock paintings. But yeah, so in summary, all of these changes in food and their basic technologies that they're coming up with and getting from other local groups of people means that the population of Sweden could really start to expand. I've seen one estimate of the south of Sweden having around 2,500 people, with the entire country approaching between 10 or 25,000 people at this point. So they're certainly beginning to become an identifiable amount of people roaming around, still in their temporary settlements, though. There's evidence of these camps and settlements that appear to be adopted for a summer and then abandoned at winter and vice versa. It's really the adopting of farming that brings the real permanence of settlement and eventual development of something more resembling villages or towns that we'll get to later.
Yeah, wow. So 25,000 people in the entire country, that's the size of a smallish town in Europe these days. But they keep going, the early Swedes. I like them. They eat their food and they make their tools and they're getting stronger, it seems. But now I think it's time to take a moment and introduce our first podcast case study.
Oh, excellent. That's exciting. What or who is this case study?
Well, I give you Birkaskogskvinnan.
What's that for the English-speaking people?
So, kvinna is Swedish for the woman, and Birkaskog is a small village in southern Sweden. So, translated to English, this is the woman from Birkaskog. Sometimes she's referred to as Barumskvinnan. Again, Barum is a small village in the south of Sweden. So, really, the name depends slightly on how you define the area where she was found.
Okay.
Now, this isn't any old Swedish lady. She happens to be one of the oldest and best preserved remains of a human being found in Sweden. So she's sort of the first Swede, if you wish.
Yeah, that's interesting. So while she's not the first Swedish person to live in Sweden, she's more likely the first person that we have remains of.
Yeah. She is one of the oldest examples of a Swedish person living, dying, and being buried in Sweden for archaeologists to find. However, she herself, when she was alive, most definitely wouldn't have had the faintest notion of being Swedish. The notion of statehood and of Sweden as a political entity, and even the concept of nationality as part of a person's identity, I mean, all of that lies many, many years into the future.
Okay, but what do we know about?
Yeah, so Birkaskogskvinnan lived around 6700 BC and was part of a community of small hunter-gatherer groups that lived in the south and southwest of Sweden. So around 8200 BC, it had gotten a lot warmer in what is today Sweden, and the last of the ice had retreated, as we mentioned. In fact, around the time when Birkaskogskvinnan lived in Sweden, the country had a nice, much more Mediterranean-style climate than what we have today. And hunter-gatherer communities, or rather hunter-gather fishing communities, to be exact, they hunted deer and ox and wild boars with few but very well-made tools. So Birkaskogskvinnan, she hung out with her friends and family members and met up with other groups for festivities and celebrations.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, yeah, it's got to the period where it's not just a battle for survival, really.
No, it's quite a nice life. I wouldn't have minded trading places with them. Sweden was, as we mentioned, with only a few thousand inhabitants, very sparsely populated, and there was no shortage for when it came to eating and enjoying what nature had to offer. These groups were nomadic communities that lived in tents or huts. But there are two things that I find particularly interesting when it comes to Bekkaskogskvinnan. The first is her gender, and the second is how she died. So, firstly, the remains of Bekkaskogskvinnan was found by a farmhand who was digging in a field in June of 1939. When archaeologists analysed the grave and the remains, they quickly determined that this was a man. Based on the fact that the skull was rather large and that the grave contained arrows, remains of fishing nets and other sort of hunting-associated tools. So those two things, a big head and some hunting tools, that meant that bish bash bosh, you're a man. At least in the eyes of 1930s Swedish male archaeologists. I mean, these guys really couldn't think outside of the box. Or at least not outside of the gender norms of their own time. Because when the skeleton was analysed by specialists in the 1970s, it actually turned out that it had belonged to a body that had given birth to several children. And I mean, that tends to be a female body.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably a given.
Yeah. I mean, this 4'9" little lady had given birth to several children, but that hadn't stopped her from also being associated with hunting and fishing. And so the man from Bekkaskog, when the remains were found in the 1930s, became the woman from Bekkaskog upon closer analysis in the 1970s.
Yeah, that's quite amazing. And it really tells you about how the history and archaeology is influenced by the time of which it's analysed or written about. And there's always new technologies coming around to date bones and all that kind of technology that's available that we have now that they didn't have back then.
And also the mindset of the people that are studying. I think we often tend to see history through the prism of our own time and judge it according to our norms and values and behaviours. And that can sometimes, as in the case with Bekkaskogskvinnan, lead to rather laughable mistakes, really.
Yeah, well, now we've dealt with who she actually was in a very basic gender sense and what she was getting up to. You mentioned something about her death.
Yeah, so when the remains were discovered, it was found that she had an arrow in her chest, close to her heart. And that made the scientists go, aha, foul play, and assume that she'd been murdered or ritually killed. However, later analysis has shown that she most likely died because of an accident, possibly from getting septicemia in a wound, and that the arrow was placed by her chest when she was buried. Now, as you said, Chris, the first example of her mistaken gender, that's an example of how mistakes are made when analysing history because we're caught in the social framework of our own time. Now, this with how she was killed and the arrow, that's more a case of not having access to as sophisticated test methods and research methods as we have today. But both things have a massive impact on how we view events in history. Bekkaskogskvinnan is interesting because she tells us a lot about life in Sweden during the Stone Age, but she also tells us a lot about the science of history itself, how it changes and how we reevaluate previous discoveries.
Yeah, that makes it a good case study for many reasons, and for as you just mentioned. And if you want to, if you're in Sweden, in Stockholm, you can go and visit the Bekkaskogskvinnan in her own exhibition in the Swedish History Museum. So please do go and see that. I haven't seen her yet, but
me neither in person, so to say. But I think it's an interesting case. And with that, I think it might be time to round off the first proper episode of a flat pack history of Sweden.
Yeah, we've made a great start. We've opened the box to our flat pack history, so to speak, and we'll keep building this up as we go.
Yeah, in this episode, we've established where we're starting from.
Yeah, we're going back a long way in history, to a place that's almost unrecognizable geographically to the Sweden that we see today.
Yeah, and we've met the first Swedes, my first countrymen.
Yeah, but although you don't have, well, I was going to say you don't have too much in common, but actually we've seen their lives weren't really that remote from life in Sweden today in terms of what they were getting up to. It was different in tools and what they might have been eating, but the general lifestyle was quite similar, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, slightly less iPod, more axe-based, but we did seem to like the same food. I wouldn't mind. This is the fourth time I'm talking about the food, but I do really like the idea of having their diet and living outdoors. I like that.
The next episode, I think we'll touch on how these early Swedes go from hunting and gathering and the monumental change of introducing farming. And we'll probably see one of the most revolutionary changes in lifestyles that we've ever had throughout human history. So I'm excited to talk about that next time.
Yeah, I can't wait. So join us next time. And in the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Flatpak Sweden. And join us next time.
Yep, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Hej då.